Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Judy Herman, and I am with Eileen Conant and Julia Pascal. Julia Pascal is the writer and Eileen Conant the director of Nineveh, which I've just seen this afternoon at Riverside Studios, where it runs until the 11th of May. So Julia and Eileen, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, it's lovely to be here.
So what we're seeing is four young men, ex-soldiers, including ex-boy soldier, trapped underground, underwater, and they have all been through horrific experiences, and they've all had to do horrific things, and that's really what we're finding out during the play. So I think I have to talk to you first, Eileen, because you're the one who sort of started with this project, aren't you? So what drew you to this sort of material? That's a big question, I guess.
It's an interesting question. I don't know if I have a very straightforward answer, but I kind of worked my way to the subject. In 2009, I ended up doing a piece with genocide survivors in Rwanda, so I was already very interested in the theme of war. And then I was doing another piece in 2010, which was about the Odyssey, and that was, we were looking at the Odysseus journey and the idea of the fight to get home after war, and realizing there were a lot of parallels with sort of returning Afghani and Iraq war vets and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
And when you say people, you're talking about American soldiers returning to America.
British and American, yeah. I mean, I was working with an American cast in the UK, so we were, the stories that were current around that time, sort of 2010, 2011, were about British and American boys coming home severely traumatized from war. So because of that piece, I got interested in the idea of global wars and other soldiers from other countries and their experiences, and I applied for a fellowship to carry out work, theater work, with veterans in four different countries. And that's how the Return Project was born.
So that was the Return Project, and this is part of that.
It is. This is actually the culmination of that. Mm-hmm. So at the very beginning of the project, before I set out, I put out a call for a producer, actually. And Julia, in her wonderful, sneaky way, wrote to me and said, I see that you're doing a project about war. I'm a writer. I'm not a producer. I'm a writer. But are you interested in having a playwright on board? And until that moment, I sort of thought I would compile some kind of devised piece from all of the work. But as soon as Julia was in touch with me, as soon as I sort of looked through her material, I went, wow, it'd be really, really exciting to work with this person. And so yeah, I decided I did want to playwright, and that was how it began.
So Julia, it's sort of the same question to you. What drew you to Eileen's work so that you wrote to her?
I've written a great deal about war and Second World War in particular, and when I saw that Eileen was doing this, it excited me because she was going out on the ground to these four different countries and accumulating research and meeting surviving soldiers. And it's another sort of survival that suddenly hit me I would like to explore through her research. So it took me on another journey, but connected to the one I'd made.
Yes, because you're more likely to have been working on themes of survivors of the Holocaust in the past, aren't you? Because of your Jewish background. This is something slightly different.
Mm. That's right. I've written a great deal about survivors from the Holocaust, as you say, and I've worked with survivors from the Holocaust as artists also, and the children of perpetrators and survivors. But this took me into another moral field, which I don't think I particularly thought about until I was halfway through the project with Eileen, when I suddenly realised I'm putting on stage, or I'm making very human people who are murderers. So it was the other side, and that engaged me in a whole other inner moral debate.
Let's talk about the raw material, and then what it is that Julia's made of it, what we're going to see.
So the countries that I went to, I started out in Lebanon, and when I was there I was working with two former commanders of different sides of the civil conflict. So one Lebanese forces intelligence officer and one communist Jordan forces commander, and they had been fighting against one another in the war, and we worked together to create a verbatim sort of farcical text that used some of their stories intercut with this kind of comedy piece, and we took that around to high schools for high school students to perform. So that was Lebanon. Then I went to Israel, and I did a piece that was much more of a sort of verbatim piece, and it was with older wounded veterans. So it was a lot about physical and emotional trauma. And then I went to Rwanda, and I worked with the 35 recently demobilized child soldiers in the Child Rehabilitation Center in Musanze. So these kids had just gotten back. I mean, some of them had been in the Congo 6 weeks before they were doing physical theater with me. So that was, I think, a journey for everybody. And really, I mean, more hopeful, I think, than any of the other, than any of the other projects to date, because it was with youth and because there was a really different sort of voice that was present there. And then the last place I went was Kashmir, but I worked with young men in a boys' college talking about sort of coming of age in Kashmir, but it wasn't as, ex-soldier focused, because I was in a current conflict zone as opposed to a post-conflict zone, and my friend and I decided to really sort of lay low at that point, so we didn't end up doing as military a project there.
So you've really used the other three more.
Yeah.
Were these your source materials, Julia? So just somebody give me an overview of what it is that you've made of it so that people will know what we're talking about, and then you can tell me how and why you made it the way you did, perhaps.
Eileen came back with an enormous amount of material from her research, and I said to her, there's so much here, we could do 25 plays. And I have a certain choice. Either I write a documentary drama play, which I particularly do not want to do, or I invent something quite fresh but inspired by and using some other material, but also putting in new material that I was finding myself, because I began then, in a way, affected by what she was doing, to search out stories that were happening in London as well. So, for example, there's a story of the young man who has his lips sewn together. Actually, doesn't come from Eileen's research, but comes from someone I know who teaches asylum seekers in London, who said to me, Julia, I know an Iranian man, he and his brother sewed their lips together in order not to be deported from Britain. Mm-hmm. So I met one of those and spoke to him, and then transplanted his experience into the experience of the young African man. So if you like, it's like a magpie choosing certain areas, most of it from Eileen, but also adding different elements of my own study. And then what do you do with all that? That was the question she and I were quite worried about. We sat down and we talked. And then Eileen told me the story of the young man who was, well, a fable that was told to her in Africa about the young man who was swallowed by a fish. And his arms have been cut off by the military. And he comes out of the fish, goes to America, the arms grow back, and he becomes a pilot. And then he goes back to his home village, and then something happens. So the minute she said that, we looked at each other, and I said, it's Jonah and the whale. It has to be a story about Jonah and the whale, but there are four Jonahs in the whale. Mm-hmm. So that was the starting premise as a framework to actually begin to think how to make a coherent story from all these disparate narratives.
Mm. Because it is actually a coherent story, and what I got out of it was that the whale being, it's almost like, not hell, it's a sort of purgatory, I thought, being in the belly of the whale. I mean, I know the story of Jonah very well. And that's what it struck me as, that they had to be cleansed in some way. And then maybe they could leave the whale, which is why I'm glad, you know, there's some hope in it, because it is quite horrific. So I don't know whether you would agree with that, Eileen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the story, it wasn't even a fable. It was actually something that the boys had, I mean, it was their fable, so it wasn't a sort of a traditional tale at all. It was something that the Rwandan boys invented on their own. And I think that, I mean, if you look through sort of like my blog entries, you'll see I'm kind of depressed and processing and reading books and trying to grapple with the subject of war for about 4 months. And then I hit Rwanda and I'm like, there's an enormous spirit of sort of hope and joy, I think, that I encountered in my projects for the very first time because of these young men who were at the center. But I'd go to their football games, you know, and we'd be cheering along and we'd drum together like they were at the beginning of their lives, and their lives were changing in a positive direction at the very, very beginning of their lives. So that was, it was very hopeful. It was enormously hopeful.
So they'd been boy soldiers, but now they've been rescued.
Demobilized. I mean, they rescued themselves, really, truth be told. They had all escaped to various Munoc centers, which, I mean, usually they'll take about a year planning their escape. So each one of them had managed to escape somehow.
What's interesting is that in the actual play, so we meet four ex-soldiers or whatever they are, only one is a boy soldier. Now the other, there's almost like a hierarchy of guilt, I felt. They're sort of vying with each other as to which had done the most terrible things, I thought. And yet, so we don't really know where they come from, because very cleverly they all have, obviously we do know the fourth one has come out of your Rwandan story, because he's young, he's a boy and he's black, so that's obviously where he's come from. The other three could be any conflict. They do have a sort of Middle Eastern accent, but it could be probably Lebanese or Israeli. But it's got that feel about it, I felt. And they are so sympathetic, even when they're talking about terrible things that they've done. Is that important to you both, I suppose?
I think it's the minute you start to talk about what you've done and you put it in a human context, that it raises the whole question of your guilt and your morality. Those three characters, or those four characters, do have a moral conscience. So I think that's why they become sympathetic. If they were just monsters who did it for the pleasure of killing, I don't think we would feel connected to them. They are deliberately not country-specific, we talked about that too, because we want the play to have a future life, and it could be any battle zone. But obviously, they're not middle-class English ex-soldiers. We're not in that territory at all, it could be the Middle East, it could be Middle Asia. One of them has a Georgian accent, it could be Eastern Europe. We know the fall of Yugoslavia is still current in our news. So, ex-Yugoslavia, I should say. Mm-hmm. So it could be anywhere, it could be anybody, and that's deliberate. That's what we wanted.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the other thing, whether or not it was deliberate that they be sympathetic, absolutely. I mean, that was the whole point of the year was for me to go out and understand and empathize and sympathize. And I don't know to what extent you can ever do that completely with another human being, but I think that the less we draw lines placing other people firmly outside the bounds of our own understanding, like that's something I will never understand or that's something I would never do, the less we kind of make those harsh black and white divisions in the world, I think the less of ourselves we're disconnected from, I think. And so there's this thing about people integrating with one another and understanding one another, and how if you can do that, you integrate with more and more parts of yourself, I guess.
I mean, what happens is that they sort of drag things partly out of each other, and partly they want to confess. It's like a confessional. But it is quite oblique. It's not that none of the confessions is straightforward, but they obviously have a huge need to talk about what they've done, and that's presumably part of a healing process, I suppose, in the belly of the whale. I mean, we know Jonah was stuck in the belly of the whale, and she actually said, okay, yeah, I will do it, I will go to Nineveh and all the rest of it. But so that's it, isn't it? It is exactly the fire of purgatory, like I said.
That's deliberate, because how do you heal from trauma? Because the exploration that Eileen's done is about trauma, and trauma is not just about war. A lot of people are traumatized for many reasons. How does a human being heal him or herself? That's a question that interests me. And is it by talking? Does the talking cure heal you? Do we need to process what's happened to us in order to understand it, in order to forgive the self? And I think it's not just about war. It's about the human condition in terms of how do we live our lives? How do we forgive ourselves for certain sins? And what's the punishment? What should the punishment be? Should there be punishment? Those are the big questions that I hope the play raises.
We should talk a bit about, we'll talk a bit about process in a minute. But the other thing that happens very interestingly is that the allegiances of the young men shift. And, they're quite interdependent. They fight a lot. And if you read it on the page, they really look as though they're incredibly unsympathetic to each other. Mm-hmm. But their body language and the way they are, the way they actually speak the lines, I mean, they're actually a support system for each other, all of them, and eventually the fourth one as well. So is that what you wanted, both of you, from a writing directing point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely the case. Yeah, if any extreme circumstance brings people together. So the affinities and the closeness that happen in war are, I've had men say to me again and again, like, I will never be as close to my wife as I am to my war buddies. It's just not possible. So I think that those extreme circumstances will create that unity. And then, interestingly, when you're all locked together in the belly of a beast, so that you are all simultaneously the enemy and the brother in arms, I mean, you have to be both then to one another. I think you find these kinds of relationships in other similar situations, like prisoner of war camps, prisons, this sort of like every man for himself, but at the same time, this huge interdependence. It's tricky. It's a very complicated relationship.
You must be pleased. I mean, it was a lot of talking that you did together that led to Julia writing it like that, was there? Yeah.
That's right, and there were fundamental questions like, who are the characters you make? And I discussed with Eileen that I think it would be best to have archetypes. So you have Johnny the leader, You have Chance, who is the damaged child. You have Richie, who is eternal student. You have Joel, who's the archetypal fool or the wise idiot, Forrest Gump, yeah, Lydia Savon. And by giving myself those constraints as character led by archetype, it helped me construct the characters, because we didn't want to go into political specifics of this is from this country, on this side, at war with this side. We just didn't want to go there. But by making the archetypes, then you had both a buddy play of interdependent people plus a triangle. There are only three people, so whenever you put a triangle on stage, you've got problems, and that's very exciting for a dramatist. So that was the framework underneath as a structure.
Yes, you get those shifting allegiances with the triangle, obviously. I want to talk about casting and rehearsal process, because you've got a very, very powerful cast of they look quite young to me, anyway, young men. So can we just name them all first?
So Joel is played by Yaron Shavit. Gethin Alderman plays Richie. Nabil Stewart plays Johnny. And John Kamau plays Chance.
All of them are excellent. Yeah. So what sort of rehearsal process did you put them through?
Funnily enough, it was not because I'm method, it's just because we're a small theatre company on a budget. We rehearsed in conditions that were not unlike the belly of a whale. we were in a massive archway called Aya Studios underneath one of those railway arches in Vauxhall, and it was freezing cold. We actually had to get one of those massive tanks, you know, the propane heaters. So it's kind of this constant noise of the heating and the trains going overhead, which sounded like a whale's digestive tract, and 4 weeks of freezing cold conditions. So it was very, what is it, experiential. Experiential rehearsal.
But I mean, what sort of things did you...
What did we look for? I mean, it was varied. I'm a very physical director. In fact, this is my first text since university, which would be, almost a decade now ago. What I usually do is I usually devise. So all of my process is very body-based, very kind of, it's about shapes and space and those kinds of dynamics. They worked with a movement director. They worked with a fight choreographer as well. So there was a lot of moving every day in rehearsal. But then also, like, all the standards. Julia's dialogue is incredibly snappy, and it's sort of one word, one word, one word. So the amount of sort of actioning and talking and wrestling with that in order to get something that makes physical sense on stage as well is really important. So we spend a lot of time going, what do you want? What do you, you know, how's the status changing? What's happening here? So there's a lot of that as well.
Those shifting allegiances.
As
you so rightly say, status comes into that as well, doesn't it? So, Julia, were you in on the rehearsal process?
I was in some of them, yes. And to explain to actors that this is not a naturalistic play was important to me, because most of them had not done plays which are not naturalistic, which made me question training in Britain, I have to say. And I had to explain some of the some musical gags in it, and to explain where the vaudeville came from, and to show style. So that was really teaching the aesthetic, the vocabulary of the aesthetic, to the actors and to the audience is pretty important. What style is it in? It's not EastEnders, yes? What do we do? What are we showing? What are we telling the audience in terms of the look, the sound, and the way it will be presented? So that was part of what I tried to do.
Yeah. It's been compared in one review to Beckett. You talk about music hall and vaudeville. Of course, there's a lot of that, for example, in Waiting for Godot. And you know, it has that feel of Waiting for Godot, in that they're stuck in this one place and they can't get away, and they've got their life experience, and that's about it. So how do you feel about that? I should think.
I'm honoured and flattered, and I think probably I come from, although I'm happily not of the same generation as Beckett, I come from a background of music hall. I was born in the north of England, Manchester and Blackpool. I know the coattails of that world, and I do use it quite a lot in my writing. So my father was a Dublin Jew, so there's a whole Irish part of my life where I connect perhaps to Eileen as well. And that area of non-naturalistic, absurd humour, I love it. And I wanted the play not to be just a heavy piece, but to have black comedy and to be extraordinary and surprising in its humour, as life is. So that, yes, that was a very important part for me.
Yes, well, there's definitely laughs there. Although what happens is it's quite hard, because it's clearly such an uncompromising and tough subject. The audience didn't quite feel they had a license to laugh, let's say. So I laughed, but it, you know, slightly low laugh. It might be because I'd already read it and I knew that that was okay. But I, you know, I think a big audience would probably would laugh.
We have had big audiences who've roared, so and it really lifts it quite a lot. Yeah, yes, people are frightened to laugh when it's a in quote serious topic, but life in all its horror is very often absurdly funny, isn't it? So why not?
The Bible's quite an important source here, and you actually. Do you need to know your Bible stories? No, I think you're probably going to tell the story anyway, aren't you? You actually managed to tell it. But it is lovely the way the story of Jonah comes in. And, of course, there it is in the title, Nineveh. And you've got a bit that you particularly like, haven't you? Yes. And Richie is the student, isn't he? Yes. This is his take?
I got it. Jonah fled God and got on a boat. Where was he? Jaffa. And God brought up a storm. And the sailors were frightened, and they asked God to stop the storm, but God was deaf. So they begged him, and he said, "You have a man on board who disobeys my orders. When you cast him off, then the winds will stop." And the sailors said, "No, we cannot throw a man into the icy sea to drown." And the storm got worse, until Jonah said to the sailors, "The man God is angry with is me. I have ignored God's command. Save your lives. Throw me off the boat. Do it." And the sailors did, and the winds dropped.
And the whale just happened to be passing by?
That shows the humour. It is funny, but it's also quite a succinct telling of that story. So. It's a lovely moment in the play. It seems to be terribly important, this reading names backwards, which you do quite a lot. Mm. It's quite clever at one point that you use Made in Nineveh and it means something else backwards. And can I just ask you what that was about? Because I wasn't sure, but it was rather wonderful.
It interests me, how do we see the world? And, for instance, if you look at Arabic and Hebrew, they're written from our point of view backwards.
Of course they are.
And so that was one way of how do I deal with the Middle Eastern research that Eileen's done. I don't want to say Israel and Lebanon. I mean, they're mentioned. And I don't want to be too specific, but by mentioning that, it's also how do we see the world? We always see it in a very particular way. Suppose you take a completely different point of view. Does it open up the world in a more generous way to you? So it's me questioning language and the whole vision of the way we look at the world.
I'm sure you thought of this, but I'll tell you something really interesting that I thought, is that, so you've got four men, but the writer is a woman, and the director is a woman, and actually I gather that the whale is female as well.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, isn't it? And there's a lot of talk about mothers and so forth. So women are there, aren't they? So first of all, Julia, I'll ask you about writing, where women stand in the writing.
That's very funny, because a Russian journalist said to me after the first night that this play feels as if it's been written by a man. Mm. And from that I took that for most people, it's not expected that women write about war or direct war on stage. I think it's very important that women do, and I have written about it, and why not? But I've talked to a lot of heterosexual men, they're clearly heterosexual men, about how they feel about women, and normally it's quite hard to get them to talk, but over the years I have. And so it was important for me to create how do men talk about women when women are not present. And I think that's quite hard to listen to. And that the love-hate, the desire and fury at desiring a woman was something I wanted to express. But also the idea of never touching another woman being very important and being a terrible thought. Mm. And also that they are in a female, they're in a whale, so which is, of course, like a uterus.
Yes, so you're saying they might be stuck there and never see another woman again. Right. Well, I think that does come over.
Yes.
Yeah, and of course, the awful thing is that the love-hate relationship they're having with women is very heightened by the fact that it's women in... We're talking about women in war. It may be someone they've raped, that they've been in a very powerful position. Clearly, at one point, it is that. And whether they're expiating that, or whether they're sorry at all. I mean, they are, they're sorry and they're not sorry, aren't they? Would you say?
Well, I mean, there's one character. It's just interesting because I think all the places that I went, women were very cherished. I feel like a woman in a war zone is the most vulnerable thing. You love your mother and you love your daughter in a way that you don't love anybody else. And I think in war, the vulnerability of women in men's eyes and kind of that like men are most vulnerable where their women are. And therefore, if your enemy is in, for example, in Kashmir, the thing that they would say again and again is that these Indian, because in Kashmir they don't consider themselves Indian, so these Kashmiri men would say, but these Indian soldiers, they're here and they can just look at our daughters. They can just look at our wives. It's just the violent act of just being able to ogle them. But that was the most violent thing they could do. It didn't matter if they were pushing you around or stopping your car or whatever. It was the fact that they were where your daughters and your wives are. So you can beat a man, you can rape a woman, and you can beat a man or you can rape his daughter. Like, those are the things you can do, you know, or you can kill a man. I don't know. That's the role of the women in the war zones in relation to the men that I was talking to. Now, there were female soldiers as well, and that's a whole other story, but that wasn't the story that I kind of experienced the most, so that wasn't the story that was focused on here.
Yeah, I think I might have overdone what I said there. I didn't mean it like that exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But one of them is expiating the fact that he'd found himself in this powerful position in relation to a woman that he wanted, and he'd taken advantage of it, but that now he was... that was part of his guilt, I think, wasn't it? Part of his guilt.
Yeah, I mean, that one came from a story... It was a friend of mine who lost his whole family in the genocide, but one of his schoolmates who had had a crush on his sister had kept his sister for 2 weeks before killing her. And so it was this thing of like, this really, I found that really bizarre, because when I think about who I had a crush on when I was in school and what that felt like, and then to stick that in a context of a world that suddenly you're surrounded by genocide and suddenly you're given a power that you didn't have. And as a young boy, you feel slighted because there is a class thing going on and you feel like this woman didn't love you because of your race or ethnic affiliation. And then you're given power and then you... For Westerners, war is something that you go away to another country and you inflict upon people that you've never met before. It's not personal. To see war in a context where it erupts in your backyard and then these really... beautiful personal relationships. I mean, the kinds of personal relationships that you and I would have had when we were kids with our classmates are then turned into wartime relationships. That was horrific to me. And so Julia's monologue really, I think, succeeded in capturing that in the ambiguity of, the kind of extreme depths and heights, I guess, of your emotions towards people in wartime contexts. I mean, just like these men can be enemies and brothers at the same time, women can be lovers and victims. They can, you know, it's very complicated. War is very complicated.
Yeah. And that, as I said before, I think the fact that you're just women, is that's where that really comes into its own. I think, you know, if it was just a whole room full of men, might not work so well, probably.
Yes, yes.
So actually, we should perhaps name some of the other women involved. The design is very much the belly of the whale. I mean, we've got what looks like the rib cage of the whale, I suppose it is. And yet, it's made of sort of military material, I think, isn't it? So that sounds a clear lith. It's a very striking set, and it's full of the detritus of war, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we wanted was for it to be a bit ambiguous. We wanted it to be possibly a ship, kind of unclear where they are until the moment where they go, we're in a whale, so that then at that moment you look around and go, oh, yeah, maybe they are in a whale. That was the aim, so...
It's got to have a possibility of lots of things you can pick up and use, hasn't it? Which she's realised brilliantly, has Claire. And, of course, and actually the lighting is just as... It usually is very important. It's particularly important here, isn't it, that you have lighting changes sometimes when you're going into a recollection, a really difficult memory, something has changed. When you're recasting people, because the various actors have to play people in other people's memories and so forth. So, again, a woman, Catherine Graham.
That's right. And I think the lighting, I particularly like the lighting in the way Eileen has been working with Catherine, because for me it evokes the question of memory. How do we process memories? And, for instance, if something terrible happens to you, in your memory, sometimes it's slow motion, sometimes it's in a colour, sometimes it's distorted. And I think the way this has been directed is very clever in terms of it asks those terrible questions about how do we as human beings process memory, and is it like a movie that just keeps replaying and replaying? How do you process trauma? And I think that's beautifully realised.
Yes, and so that, Eileen, so obviously that's where the lighting came into its own for you as well. I mean, that's your idea, wasn't it? You worked closely with her on those ideas, with Catherine.
Yeah. I mean, Catherine, she basically went off. I gave her free rein. And as a lighting designer, she's done a lot of installation pieces. So she very much treats the lighting as a fifth character in the play, which is exactly what I wanted her to do, and it's always shifting, always moving, much like memory, so it creates that feeling of a living, breathing space.
And we just have to add to that Felipe Gomez, who did the sound design, because the sound is like a sixth character, really, isn't it? Yeah, so that, again, you know, the weird sounds that we don't really know what they are. They might be threatening, or just mysterious. But if you were in the belly of a whale, or if you were in a submarine or a war zone, it seems to muddle up the whole lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great, actually. He's actually taken a lot of clips from my year, so he's taken some of our interviews in Arabic and Hebrew and Kinyarwanda, mixed them in, so you have these weird whispers happening. He's taken a lot of sounds of planking and creaking and kind of morphed that into the sounds of whale calls. So he's done the same thing in terms of, with sound, I think, that Catherine's been doing with lights, which is that he's creating a breathing space and one that changes over the course of the play.
Let's just talk a little bit about some of the places that you were. Let's sort of go around in full circle. So when you were in Israel, you were dealing with young men who had served in the IDF, in the Israeli Defense Force, or...?
They weren't young. Men that we interviewed, so in Israel it was a bit different. It wasn't actually working with the soldiers. It was more of a traditional verbatim theater piece in that we interviewed ex-fighters who were much older. They were, most of them in their sort of 60s. Like and 70s, like the many of them were like landmine victims from the Yom Kippur War and stuff like that. So from the 70s, and they had really suffered massive physical trauma. So they were blind, or they were missing limbs, or and they talked about the process of healing from physical trauma. And at the same time, I was doing all these interviews with these younger soldiers from sort of the 2006 Lebanon War, and then most of them hadn't come away with physical traumas, but they had come away with a lot of real psychological trauma. So that was kind of the body of work kind of became a verbatim piece that paralleled those things, physical and psychological trauma, and how do we process that and heal from that, basically.
Julia, I mean, obviously, you've got a relationship with Israel. You've done play. You did a play called Crossing Jerusalem that was set in Israel. Yes, I remember that one very well. And of course, what's interesting is there's a film called Lebanon, which is entirely set inside a tank. And it is to do entirely with the trauma of being in the 1982 war, I think. And they tune another film about an Israeli soldier shot down over Lebanon. Israel itself is constantly, at least the artistic community, analysing and reanalysing and trying to make sense of the trauma that it's putting itself through, I suppose you could say. So that was that one of the things that attracted you to this project?
Very much so. And I was in Israel, in fact, during the rehearsal period. I was there in March, so I always try and see what's the change that's going on, because it moves all the time. But I've also done a lot of interviewing myself of former IDF soldiers, because one meets them, one knows them, even some of my family, of course. There's trauma in my own family from the Yom Kippur War. What I picked up mostly was that quite a few of them had said to me that they never discuss what happened with their wives or the women in their family, which I did put into the play, because I thought that was pretty fascinating, that men can have a shared experience that they will never share with women, because it's just too impossible to describe. And so that directly comes out of the Israel experience, but absolutely, yes.
It's interesting. There's a song in Oh, What a Lovely War, say, you know, they'll never believe, we're not going to tell them what actually happened. We'll pretend that we had a ball over there and we sat around in cafes, not that we went over the top and lived with rats. And that's what you're saying, isn't
that's
it?
That's absolutely right, yes. Mm. There's a whole silence, I think, between men and women as to what goes on. And that silence, I think, is... How do you express that? How do you express the inexpressible? And that's something that I was trying to explore, because the men, in fact, they start to talk about it, but they never really finish their sentences, because they both understand. They don't even need to. Mm. I mean, we have an Israeli actor in here.
Yes, Yaron Shavit. I mean, does that lend it some authenticity? Was it good to have an Israeli actor in it? Or was it just he was the best one who came to the audition and you wanted him?
It's interesting, actually. There was something important to me about Indigenous casting. When I first came back and we did our R&D sort of in
research and development.
Yeah, we did a 1 week of rehearsal in December. And at that point, I was like, I want a Pakistani actor if I can't get a Kashmiri. I was very, very like, my producers were sort of tearing their hair out. And what I ended up realizing, I mean, the first manifestation, we actually did have a Lebanese guy, and then we had Yaron, who came in. It was really important at that point that he was Israeli. John came in at that point, and, you know, he was a Kenyan. He was born in Kenya, so that was important to me, that, you know, kind of vaguely East, Easterly African. Because there were things, I mean, really basic things, the way that John... moved when he made the sound of that man, why does he smell so bad, and he went and he just there were things that he had that were just immediately that took me right back and went okay, you embody something that I cannot train into somebody who was born here. So that was very important. But then it was also crucially important that the people were also incredible actors. And John and Yaron stayed on. And as we were recasting, two of the other guys, the Lebanese guy had to go, and the other guy was based in Scotland, so it wasn't practical. As we were recasting, and we were seeing a lot of people, we started to go, you know what, at the end of the day, this dialogue is really, really snappy. And if it's a British guy or a Welsh guy or a Scottish guy who can do an accent, then that's fine, you know what I mean? And it was interesting to see myself go through that process of when you're... your ideals and then the practicality and then the, you know, there's that conflict as well. But I think they do bring something, both Yaron and John. It's not that people who are not from other countries can't bring something as well, but for me, international collaboration is important because you get something different. And I think that that's what, as artists and as people, we're always looking for is something new, something different, something that teaches us more or takes us further.
So, obviously, we've got this play about this process of, I think, redemption. So what do you want the audience to get out of it? What do you want for your play?
That's a good question. I think I don't know what I want for the audience, because I think what I came in with a question as a human being and as an artist, and it was a question about redemption and hope. And I think that there are some plays that you make because you have a point to make, and there are some plays that you make because you have a question to explore. And I think that this is coming so deep into the exploration part of my journey with this theme that I don't have a point yet. And I think that making the plays only brought me closer to a point. I don't think I've realized the point, if that makes any sense. I don't know what my relationship or my beliefs are about trauma and healing and hope. I know that I struggle with this question of, are there things that are so horrific that they just don't make us better people, or there's no like easy philosophy or pat way of dealing with them psychologically, spiritually? Are there things that we just would have been better off not having lived? Mm. And I don't know the answer to that. I'm hoping the answer is no, but I don't know.
That's good. I have 2 points, really. We interviewed a former child soldier from Sierra Leone called Messe Leone. And he said he was taken very young into the rebel armies. And he said, if someone was to send me back today, I would say to them, kill me. Which I found pretty fascinating, because it meant that he couldn't bear to think of what he has done. And I think I know a snippet of what he's done, but not all of it, obviously. For me, the play, it came through something. Eileen brought back an image of the books that were sealed in Lebanon that she had come across, history books that were given by the USA.
It's all a bit messy, but basically the backstory is that USA had given Hezbollah these readers, which quite innocently had all of these passages about the Holocaust, which I think is, it's a bit inappropriate considering that Lebanon doesn't even get to study its own history at this point, so it was already a bit dodgy. But then Hezbollah also probably inappropriately glued those pages shut when they were distributing those readers. So those, you know, 10 chapters or whatever, you couldn't be read by the students. So it was a bit faffy and messy all the way around. So,
you took that image, I know.
So yeah. I took the image because I found it very striking. What are we not allowed to read? And it's a central motif in the play itself. So the book, as I was writing, it became more and more important, because when I met this former child soldier, he clearly had no education, because his education had been arrested, just as so many Holocaust survivors I'd met had never had any education, for obvious reasons. So the book started to become more and more important in the constructing of the text. And then I allowed it, if you like, to grow and grow and grow, and becomes a primary impulse. And the book, which belongs to the eternal student in the play, Richie, becomes seized upon by the young African child as something he has to have. He has to have learning. And I think for me, to go back to your question, we can only get out through learning, through reading, through understanding, through asking questions. There is no one central answer. But the act of asking questions, which is quite Talmudic, of course, in thesis and antithesis, is something that has, and the play is full of questions, is something that drives the play forward. And the last image of the play is the African child lifting his hand with the book into the light. And for me, that symbolic interest, that symbolic image of the book into the light is the way out and is the message of the play. It's education.
So, Eileen and Julia, thank you so much for your time and for all the frankness.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.